Welcome to the Nonprofit Hub Radio Podcast, where we highlight nonprofit innovators, leaders, and influencers every week that are changing the sector for the better. I'm your host, Delaney Mullenix, Executive Director of Nonprofit Hub. If you're not for profit and all for purpose, you're in the right place. You see, we know you're already doing good, but we've designed this podcast to help nonprofit professionals find growth, joy, and connection. So tune in weekly for new episodes to elevate your cause, spread the news, and share the resources we share with you.
We'd like to thank Neon One for sponsoring today's episode of the Nonprofit Hub Radio Podcast. Neon One envisions a world where nonprofits are empowered with the technology and resources to build a community of generosity. Join 6,500 other organizations and accelerate your work with a connected nonprofit platform. Learn more at neononeone.com/nonprofithub. That's neononeone.com/nonprofithub.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Nonprofit Hub Radio Podcast. I'm Delaney, the Executive Director of Nonprofit Hub. This is probably one of my favorite podcast episodes that I've ever had the pleasure of doing. I interviewed Julie Bowl. She is the founder of Julie Bowl Consulting, and she is actually a Dare to Lead certified instructor. For those of you who are Dr. Brené Brown fans, she actually uses this framework to help nonprofit leaders develop courage and have the bravery to lead. And we talk a lot about why that is especially important in the nonprofit sector. We discuss characteristics of a courageous leader and how these behaviors, these tangible behaviors, can really help to either build or erode trust in organizations. Julie, it's such a pleasure to have you on today.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to talk to you and the audience.
Yes. I will kind of let you just kick us off. And I think it's really awesome for those of you who are fans of Dr. Brené Brown. Julie is an expert in her work and is a trained facilitator on the Dare to Lead. Sounds like there's all this programming involved. Some of you who may have read the book. But Julie, yeah, tell us more about you. Tell us more about the programming and your background.
Absolutely. So my name is Julie Bowl, as you said. I have been in the nonprofit sector for about 20 years. I started in marketing, so we have that in common. And I kind of fell into grants. And the reason I loved grants so much is because we have this mindset in the nonprofit world sometimes, like, we can't do anything new. We don't have money. And I was like, I can make money, you know, I can make money and then we can do these new things. So we did fun things, like we created a mascot for the library that I was at, and he ended up driving a card holder race, like fun things. Like, so money ended up being a way to create change in the nonprofit world. And so I stayed in that space of grants for about 10 years. And I thought, I'll go out on my own, I'll be a consultant, and I'll just help nonprofit organizations write grants. Very, very, very quickly, I realized the work that I wanted to do with the nonprofits was around strategy. Like, why are you taking this path? What's the evidence you have to support it? What are your goals? Like, because if we can get that all figured out, the grants will write themselves. So I moved into strategic planning. Then I just fell into this opportunity to be a facilitator for Dr. Brené Brown. Her work is around courage building, and it is so necessary. And I know we'll talk about this for the next 20 minutes or so in the nonprofit sector to be able to build this skill set. So I went from like this idea that money was going to fix, you know, all of our problems in the nonprofit world. I have a $10 million track record in grants. And what I know is money doesn't really fix anything. So the largest grant that I've gotten is about $2.5 million. Wow. And if the same people with the same ideas are doing the same things, it doesn't really matter if you infuse that much money into it.
Yeah. Or how many people are doing it, right?
Yes. So it's really about the people that are driving the organization and their capacity more than it's about money, more than it's about strategy. So I still do strategy work, but I love bringing Dare to Lead, Brené Brown's work and philosophy into nonprofit organizations because I think we need the work. So that's what I do. Probably 50% of my time is just teaching those tools to nonprofit employees, leaders, organizations, and helping them change the culture of their organization and build trust. I know that's something we're going to talk about a little bit today, too.
Yeah. So where are you doing this work? Do you do this nationally or do you do it?
Yes,
you live?
I do. So I'm actually from a small town in Illinois. And the reason that I started my own business, because there's no such thing as a full-time grant writer in my community, aside from the university where I was at. So I was like, I guess I got to create one. Then the pandemic happened and the facilitation work with Brené Brown used to be completely in person. And that was the business model because they didn't want to mess with virtual. Well, of course, with the pandemic, they had to.
Yeah.
And what that did for me is it opened me up to all sorts of engagements globally with Dare to Lead. So all of my work is outside of where I'm at, actually. All of it's virtual. I do travel and do 3-day engagements for people. But if we do like a long-term 8, 10, 12-week engagement, we do that virtually. And it can be done, which is amazing. And one of the silver linings of the pandemic is we had to innovate and adapt.
Yeah. Yeah, we definitely all did.
We did.
It's probably obvious and I don't need to, you know, spend time making sure people understand that to lead in any facet takes bravery and courage. But why is bravery and courage so necessary and why are these vital characteristics for leaders to have in the nonprofit space?
Yes, such a good question. So I have been in this space for about 20 years. And we have this kind of idea that we're nice in the nonprofit world. You know, we're nice and we don't make people uncomfortable and this and that. But at the end of the day, to serve our mission, we have to be clear and direct and we have to stand up for the people that we serve. And so we were talking earlier before we went live, you know, we have board members that are typically people of means and influence and education levels. And often we're serving a much different demographic. And so you've got this tension between, you know, the leadership and the influence of the organization and then what's best for your demographic and who you serve. And that doesn't always mesh. Mm-hmm. So a nonprofit leader has to walk that line and be able to advocate for the people they're serving, even if it goes against the grain of what traditionally some of the folks on the board might think is correct, quote unquote, the right thing to do, you know?
Yeah.
So I just think, and then walking the line with funders and advocating for the needs of your people when you have all these power dynamics with the board, with funders, there's just a lot going on where you have to be able to stand up and speak up on behalf of the people you serve, even if it doesn't necessarily go with the status quo.
Yeah. Yeah. You definitely do need to be that advocate and that spokesperson. But to your point, so often you're put in the position of harmonizing everyone, even if it doesn't get you anywhere.
There's a cost to that. There's a cost to trying to make everyone happy. And it's a mission. It's the people you serve. There's a cost.
Yeah. I mean, some of the most brave and courageous people I've met are leaders in the nonprofit space. They certainly exist in the private sector and the public sector for sure. But I'm just curious on a personal level, working with your experience teaching this program and just being in the space for so long, have you seen shifts in generations when it comes to bravery and courage? I mean, what does that look like in different generations?
Yeah, so it's really interesting that you say that, because what I ask when I go into an organization is like, why do you want to do this work? Why is this work important? And oftentimes people will say to retain new talent, because the newer generation of people coming in have a different idea of what work-life balance it should look like. Sure. There's higher expectations of, you know, personal growth and personal boundaries. And that language is much more familiar and common with this newer generation than it is with, you know, people my age or older who kind of have this mentality of like work, 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 work. And there's a real downside to that mentality. So to talk about generationally, I think when you do the work that I do, which is, you know, teaching people boundaries and how to speak up and how to be clear and how to lean into your values, I really think this younger generation coming in is just more positioned to take in that work. It's not quite as heavy of a lift as it is for some of us who've been around a while.
Right. Yeah.
When you say, you know, teaching people how to like lean into their values and know their values, I often find that, you know, your personal values might not align with organizational values, but if you're a leader in your organization, I mean, what is the difference between leaning into your personal values and leaning into your organizational values? Cause like you will have to do both, right? As a leader in the nonprofit space. So how do you consult on that or teach that in your programming? If you are, again, you know, working with people who are leading organizations, but also helping to make sure that they're doing that like on a personal level too.
Yes. So the interesting thing is this work is disrupting, because what you're saying, if your personal values don't align with your organization's values, there's always going to be a conflict there.
Yeah.
And it's going to erode at you. And so if I come in, you know, when I do coaching inside organizations, I tell the organization, I'm going to coach the person. And so the best thing for that person might be to leave. But then that's the best thing for you as well. Because if that person's out of alignment, then there's always going to be that friction there. So having clarity on your personal values is something we do in the Dare to Lead work. Because if you can't get clear on your values and name them and name the behaviors that align with them, you can't, you can't pinpoint when you're in and out of alignment. So I think we can all look back at difficult periods in our life and say that there was a values misalignment there. The reason I left the last employer I was at is the way that women were treated. It was just a very difficult environment and very few women leaders and very just dismissive around women. And there was no amount of performance I could do that was going to make that okay for me.
Right.
So knowing what your values are as a leader and knowing if they align with the organization, I think is really important. And then on the organization side, we talk about this. I think this is a big issue in the nonprofit world, but we tend to have, so I used to write grants. I wrote grants for years and I would always say, what's your mission statement? What's your vision statement? What's all, you know, we have all the things in our toolkits. But sometimes we just have them in our toolkit. We don't actually use them or practice them. And so it's kind of like, you know, we have this thing, the statement on the wall, but is the behavior that we see in the hallway or the break room or in the front lines of the organization aligning with that, those values that we say are important to us?
Yeah.
And if they're not, then you have a trust issue in your organization because we say one thing and we do another thing.
Yeah. I love the saying, culture dies if you don't talk about it.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So I've started to shift into helping organizations actually behavioralize. Brene uses that word, so I'm going to pretend it's a word. I don't know if it is or not, but actually define behaviors that align with their values so that they can hold their teams accountable and say, okay, here's what it looks like to practice this value. When, you know, we work with a client XYZ, when we, whatever it might be. Big thing is like the clear is kind. Like if there's an issue, we're willing to talk about it. We normalize giving constructive feedback, all of those things.
Yeah, that's actually behavioralizing organizational values is exactly how we do our performance reviews. So performance reviews, they are based on like the employee's specific job responsibilities, but it's organized by the core values of our organization. And then underneath of each core value, there are behaviors that that person exhibits in their role that apply to their role. And then that's what they're rated on a level of 1 to 5.
That is amazing. Mm-hmm. I love that. I would love to see that. I'm sure the audience would too. I mean, just to actually like walk the walk, say these values are so important to us that when we evaluate one another, we're actually looking through that lens.
Yeah.
Huge. I love that.
And then it makes it easier for them to understand what it is that they should be doing to apply that. Obviously, some people pick it up naturally, some people don't. I think it's actually called a 5x5x5 review. I want to say it's a tool used in the entrepreneurial operating system.
I love that. I don't know if anybody does anything like the EOS concept with nonprofits, but I totally think we should.
I know a couple of nonprofit organizations who use it. We adopt certain pieces. We don't apply it, you know, super formally, super strict and like rigid in terms of using everything, but I do love it so much that I've chosen tools that I want, right? Like I like the ritual rest. I like the organizational charts, the accountability chart. I like the L10 meeting. But I don't do everything that is.
That's awesome. Huge. Actually saying that we walk the walk of what we say is important to us. Yeah. And then we hold one another accountable to that.
Build momentum and be unstoppable at the 2023 Cause Camp Nonprofit Conference. Cause Camp is named one of the top nonprofit conferences of the year. Everyone who attends the conference is there to work with you to solve real issues facing your organization, from trivial to complex. Level up your professional knowledge and the strategies of your organization with insights from the top minds in the sector. Get to know nonprofit peers nationwide at pre- and post-show events and visit over 35 resource and solution providers in Camper Village. Join us on September 14th and 15th on America's Rock and Roller Coast in Huron, Ohio. For more than 150 years, people have chosen the Lake Erie region as their destination to connect with each other and create new memories. Grab your ticket at www.cause.camp and reignite your purpose at Cause Camp 2023.
Hi, this is Kevin Burgess, the editor of the Nonprofit Hub Radio podcast. Spreadsheets and clunky databases take so much time to manage and leave many opportunities on the table for nonprofits. With Neon One, you can take a modern approach to donor engagement and easily stay connected with your constituents. In today's environment, managing donors, members, volunteers, fundraising, and grants should happen in a secure and user-friendly environment. See how Nonprofit One enables nonprofits to leave the spreadsheets and outdated databases behind with a connected nonprofit platform. Visit neonone.com/nonprofithub. That's neonone.com/nonprofithub. Now let's get back to today's episode.
Outside of behavioralizing the org's core values, what are behaviors and characteristics of a courageous leader? What do they look like?
So this is what's so interesting about Brené, is she started out researching shame. And you would think, what does that have to do with leadership? Shame is the number one emotion that will take us outside of our integrity as a leader. So courageous leaders are self-aware and they have awareness around their own shame triggers. I did a workshop last month and I had someone that said, I don't experience shame. I don't get ashamed. I did it. Well, there's not awareness there. So we had to dig and dig and dig to say, okay, what is it? So having awareness around when we're experiencing shame and actually being able to regulate ourselves and stay mindful and stay aware of the thoughts that are coming up, huge superpower that all courageous leaders have. So that resilience piece, the emotional literacy, emotional intelligence, we think all of this stuff is soft skills, but it underpins our capacity to be a leader, to be in hard conversations and not get triggered and not get, you know, carried away by the story we make up in our head and stay curious and stay in the moment. So that is a huge cornerstone of courageous leaders. And what I love about Brené's work is all of this is teachable, measurable, and observable. So it's not like you have it or you don't. You can build these skill sets. You can build these muscles, essentially.
Yeah. What can you speak a little bit more to those shame triggers? Just, I mean, for people listening and they're like, do I feel shame?
Yes. It's so interesting because some of the language that we talk about in Dare to Lead is familiar language, but we have preconceived notions of what it is. So we spend a lot of time talking about, okay, shame is this feeling that I am not enough, essentially. And so if we were to compare shame versus guilt, guilt is I did something bad and shame is I am bad. We can't fix shame. If you're bad, you think there's something fundamentally wrong with you, you're going to react in a very consistent pattern way. Versus if you experience guilt, you actually have the chance to change it because it's not you that's fundamentally broken. So shame is that feeling that we're not enough in some way, shape, or form. And so we do a lot of like exploration around, you know, think about a time that you did something really hard and you had a fall. And what happened? What did you feel in that moment? What was some of the thinking that was happening? So we take people through this exercise so that they can kind of say, oh yeah, that's what it felt like. And then start to recognize. So your physiology for shame is going to be the same every time. So once you figure out what it is, you're going to recognize it as it comes up. Did I answer your question as far as like what shame is, that the feeling that there's something wrong with me essentially?
Yeah. Is there like an example that you could give, for instance, like obviously without saying who the person was or giving away any identifying information, but like an actual real life situation where a leader was feeling shame for something that happened?
I'll use my story. So I actually use this when I go through the workshop, and I was in Texas becoming a facilitator, gosh, in 2019. And at that time we went through this exercise, and a year had passed since this event, and I was still able to process this. It's really, really interesting. So when I became a consultant, one of the things I wanted to do was something called compression planning. It's a visual brainstorming process with the boards and the cards, very old school, very effective. And got my first strategic planning client, you know, kind of stuck my neck out and designed a 5-hour session to run with this client. And for the first 4.5 hours, it was beautiful. I was so proud of it. I had a retired superintendent with me. We were having fun. We were going back and forth, really good ideas. And at the 4.5 hour mark, we just got stuck on like a really hard topic. And I could see the executive director getting really uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And so then all of a sudden I was like, oh no, like I need to protect her. What's going on? And a board member got kind of confrontational with me and said, what are you going to do to fix this? And I immediately had this like, oh my God. So like my breath, you know, was kind of shallow. And I just instantly had this feeling of like, who do you think you are? Who did you think you were to think you could run this session? You have no idea what you're doing. And so what I did in that moment was just kind of like, hurry up and finish the session and just be like, you know, and wrap up. And I truly basically had a story in my head that I failed. And a year later, I processed this story while I was becoming a facilitator. And there's this whole process of saying, okay, what story did I make up in that moment? So the shame trigger for me was a board member saying, what are you going to do to fix this? Like, you created this problem. And I just immediately went to, you don't know what you're doing. You're not good enough. All of that stuff, had the physical, like almost tunnel vision and kind of short of breath. And I hurried up and I tried to get out of the situation as quickly as I could. And when I went back and like reflected on it, so that's the idea with writing out your SFD, your shitty first draft, is to actually.
I never heard that before.
Shitty first draft. You have an SFD. So that's what we teach this. So there is definitely language here, but we teach this process of like, find a moment where you got triggered like that and you had this reaction, and then start to really unpack what was the story you were telling yourself, and then challenge the story. So the story I was telling myself is, I have no idea what I'm doing. Who did I think I was? Da, 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 da. And when I actually went through the exercise and challenged myself, what I realized is that I was prepared. You know, I did my homework. I went through the training. I knew the client really well. The first 4.5 hours went really well. And at the end of the day, that concern from both the ED and the board member is a sign of passion around the issue. And the issue was unresolved. I mean, those things are true.
Yeah.
But you get to rewrite the ending when you go through this process. And basically what I decided was, I'm proud of the fact that I did it. You know, I learned a lot from it. And there was a positive, you know, so so your question was like example of shame. So that was it. Being in front of the room and having someone challenge me gave me a shame reaction. Yeah. But the resilience piece is actually going back, unpacking it, and saying, no, what really did happen? And what do I know is true? And basically, what do I want to take with me? Like, how do I want this to serve me moving forward?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a really awesome question to ask. I love that. I know like one of the big things that you wanted to talk about today, and you know, I'm assuming one of your passions for helping serve the nonprofit sector and helping the sector thrive is how to build trust in organizations.
Absolutely.
What does this concept of courageous leadership and bravery, what does that have to do with building trust?
Yeah, so courageous leaders are people who can build trust within organizations. So when we think about trust, we think like it's an optional thing. But if you compare and contrast like what a high trust organization looks like versus a low trust organization, do you have an experience where you can think of like someone that you had to work with that you didn't trust?
Yes.
Without naming names. So when you think about that experience, what are some words that come up for you?
Stress, anger,
resentment.
Yeah.
Like guardedness. There's like this energy around being in an environment where you don't trust the person you're with.
Mm-hmm.
And then you contrast that with, you know, when you work with someone you do trust, like what kind of words come up when you think about someone you really trust that you work with?
Safe.
My gosh. Yeah. When we think about like guarded versus safe, what kind of innovation is happening in those two environments? It's profound. So if we want our nonprofits to be effective, we have to have trust. We have to have safe environments where people can, the definition of innovation is something that's never happened before. Well, if we're in this guarded environment, we're angry and we're resentful and we don't want to share ideas, we're not going to be innovating in those spaces versus when we have safe spaces, we're actually putting ideas out there that could impact service delivery for our people in such a profound way. So it is so critical. We don't give it enough attention and space, but our best leaders in the nonprofit sector have spaces where people feel safe and seen and heard. And it just fuels, you know, autonomy and innovation and all kinds of beautiful things that we need in our space.
Yeah. And talk about, you know, burnout, which is so prevalent among nonprofit leaders. And I think that that trust relationship and that trust base that you just described, it's missing from a lot of different areas, like not only between maybe the leader and the board or the leader and staff, but even between the organization and vendors or consultants or other things that could drain so much of your energy if you don't have trust for that person or that vendor or that employee, right? Like if you can't trust your staff, if you can't trust your web dev company, if you can't trust your Google grant manager, if you can't trust your grant writer, like you either need to like work on the relationship, and if it's not fixable, then you need to like get rid of it. Like it's not worth being in that environment that's draining and it's not leading to innovation.
Yes, the cost is too high. And we think, again, we're being polite by allowing behavior, but the problem is that the good people will leave. And so you allow behavior and it sends a message to everyone else on the team that this is okay. Absolutely. Trust is, I think, directly correlated with burnout. We have to have environments where it's okay to say, I need help and ask for help. That's a sign of trust that you're willing to ask for help. And we have to, it's interesting with this Dare to Lead work. It's not uncommon for folks to call me and say, I want to train my leaders, but not actually want to get trained themselves. Mm-hmm. You can't do this work if the people at the highest level aren't modeling the work. Yeah. And so that's going to be putting boundaries in place, saying what's okay and what's not okay in our organization and protecting your people.
Yeah, of course. Well, this has been a fantastic conversation. I would love to do this like once a week with you.
Yes, exactly. It's such an important.
Where can our listeners find you and connect with you?
So I've got a website, juliebowlconsulting.com. I do Dare to Lead work inside nonprofit organizations and strategic planning. And then, of course, on LinkedIn, Julie Bowl. So either one would be a great place to connect with me.
Amazing. And we'll make sure that those links are in your podcast notes so that people can find you easily. We always do try to include a segment at the end of every episode called Good News for Nonprofits. What is something that you would like to leave with everyone today?
So burnout is starting to become more of a conversation. I think, you know, awareness is the first part of creating change. So I like that it's coming up. There's research around it now that we are starting to recognize the cost, essentially, of burnout and maybe reimagine what healthy nonprofits could look like. I have seen them. I have worked with them. They're out there. So I think that's what's good news in the nonprofit world is awareness around this burnout as the number one enemy of your organization. The cost of turnover is too high. Mm-hmm. And then the fact that there are healthy nonprofits that are doing it in a different way and actually protecting themselves and their people and still performing.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Something really cool that I saw too, and it's getting talked about more. People are trying to come up with solutions, and it's not going to be an easy solution or an easy fix. And it's going to look different for every organization too and every leader. But something that I absolutely loved seeing was an organization decided to hire three co-executive directors versus one. And they write about their story and how it's working and how it's going for the organization and stuff like that. And I was like, wow, that's super cool.
Yes. And even kind of moving away from the scarcity mindset that we can't hire people, that we can't bring in talent, that we can't, like, we have to do everything ourselves. I've worked with, and again, the people that are going to bring me in for strategic planning have the budget for it. They realize they have to make these investments. So I'm just seeing that more and more when people are saying we have to operate like a high performing organization,
right?
Which means we need to invest in resources and infrastructure and people, and that pays off.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's really been a pleasure speaking with you, Julie. Thank you for taking the time and talking with the Nonprofit Hub Tribe today. Hopefully we'll talk to you again soon.
Awesome. That'd be great.
But yeah, thank you again. And we will talk to you guys next week on the next episode of the Nonprofit Hub Radio podcast. Thanks for joining us for this Nonprofit Hub Radio podcast episode. For more resources on fundraising, marketing, and all things nonprofit, be sure to check out the number one nonprofit toolbox at nonprofithub.org. We hope you'll join us next week for another episode of the Nonprofit Hub Radio podcast.